Welcome to Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me is Elric Kane. Are you feeling spooky season yet?
No, it's so sunny and so hot that when I
Oh my
walk down the
God.
street, I said my neighbors who live just down the street, who I really dig because they have those two things that are like, I don't know how were they like 20-foot skeletons and 20-foot.
Yes.
Okay, so they have two of them that they bring up like right on the day. So a couple of days ago that popped up. I think like local housing thing makes them take it down eventually, but usually it's there for like 2 months after Halloween, which I respect. So I love that they do it, but no, I'm not like told you, I'm an October 1st guy or the last day of September. that's when it all turns.
No,
That's when it
like
switches.
I'm putting mine up next week. I kept my skeletons up last year till Christmas, and we put Christmas decorations on them and then took them down. But I figured like they're honestly like pains in the asses to put up. So I was kind of like, well, they're staying up. And then we just swapped out the Halloween for Christmas sweaters and stuff.
September is usually like Bergman time, so I've got all my Bergman decorations. Like there's an old Ingmar in the window and an old Ingmar.
You've got
Yeah,
your Ingmar tree, which is
it's an
just
Ingmar tree. It's just like, you
It's a
know.
ficus that you hang like
Yeah.
little Ingmar quotes
A little
on. It's
Criterion Collection tree, you know. We take it serious around here.
Ingmar Day is going to have to be a national holiday now. Somebody create that, please, and send us
Tomorrow's
pictures of your
Persona Day.
Ingmar
It's a
tree.
big one, yeah.
Persona Day, of
And then we
course.
all gather around to feast on the Through a Glass Darkly Day. That is the big one where we all come together to be a little sad
I was
and
going to say, this is a
morose.
bleak month. I just, the virgin spring month is just, oh, that's, I'm sad thinking about it.
Still
I'll
one of the best
see
double
you.
features I ever did at the NewBev when I first moved here. I think it was really early on moving here was Virgin Spring and Last House on the Left. And it made Last House on the Left like 10 times better a movie
It
watching
makes it
Virgin Spring right
smart.
before. Yeah,
It
like if you
makes
watch
it
it
so
right before.
smart because you're like, oh
Yeah.
my God, he's like
Yeah.
taking this like classic work of
Yeah.
cinema and then turning it into this like exploitation film, but obviously pulling a lot of the artistic nuances. And
Totally. No, it
suddenly
really
you're
did.
like, Krug gets really smart at that point.
Yeah, no, it was a weird, it's surprisingly really good double.
So you missed trivia last
Oh,
month or
that's
last
fair.
week because you got to go to the Magic Castle, which is pretty damn cool. But I did an entire Scandinavian horror trivia round.
Okay,
And
hit me with
so,
one question to see
oh,
if I
okay.
could.
Well, I asked what is Ingmar Bergman's horror
Hour of the
film.
Wolf.
There you go. I feel like
That's
I
just my
need to
all-time
pull.
favorite.
I'm gonna pull this round up and I'm gonna hit you with random questions throughout
Okay.
the
Yeah,
episode
let's do it.
today.
Let's do it.
I'm doing it. Just random
On the
questions.
fly.
So I'm gonna give, let's see here. I got one more. Let me pull, I'm pulling up. Everybody's listening to this in real time. I
For the real
also
Bergman heads out there, I will say he kind of has another heart. That's a real nightmare movie. But there's this one called Silence, The Silence, which I would say is almost feels like a horror film. It feels like an A24 horror film, but from the 60s, because it doesn't have any horror imagery. But man, the feeling of it is very like weird. It's two sisters on a train and it's in a weird war. It's just freaking weird. So
Ooh.
yeah.
You also missed my stoner horror round, which
I
is
might have fared less well in there.
I figured so. Basically, as Jared noted at the top, you're either gonna ace the Scandinavian horror round or you're not gonna get any. So I will also ask you the second
Okay.
question of in the original Speak No Evil film from 2022, what two Scandinavian countries are the two families from?
Sweden and Denmark.
Incorrect. Netherlands and Denmark.
Oh, Netherlands. I knew Denmark, the Danes were one of them. Oh, I thought it was Sweden. I guess I've got Bergman on the
It's
brain.
okay. I'll give you more later.
Okay, all right.
Okay. So, with that, what all have you been watching?
Oh, well, let's the first thing I got to
Oh.
talk about. Oh, but no, you've got one to share afterwards. But trust me, this one I need to tell you first. Jaws 3D and 4DX 50th
Where?
anniversary screening at all theaters, like all weekend. It's been playing that way. Now,
Oh, okay. I did see advertisements for this.
here's the thing. Like, there's great movies that are always great, but like if you don't watch one for a while, then it gets real great. I hadn't seen Jaws. I'd seen the sequels to Jaws more recently than I'd seen Jaws. I probably haven't seen Jaws maybe just over a decade, let's say. Maybe since we've been podcasting. I don't know if I've seen the whole thing.
Really?
I watch the opening every year. I show it to students for a sound thing, but I hadn't watched the whole thing, even though I feel like it lives pretty well in my brain, but there was still a lot of stuff I'd forgotten. But in 3D, which I usually would not be excited about a post-convert thing, but Spielberg oversaw this a few years ago, and somebody whose podcast I listened to a bunch had been going on about it for years, saying it's one of the best converted 3D things they'd ever seen, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, oh, I really want to see that. Then my friend Star was like, well, it's playing out here in 4DX as well. And we'd only done Furiosa in that. And it was a kind of horrific experience where your body was bruised afterwards.
I've
And I was,
heard it
yeah, it
hurts.
was pretty bad. So I was like, I don't know if I want to ruin Jaws if it's going to be like that. But this is the 50th anniversary screening, which is obviously a big deal. And we went and the 4DX, okay, two things. The 3D is very subtle. It only really hammers home a few things, but the number one thing it does is something that Spielberg already did, especially in those first few movies he made, is it makes you very aware of the depth staging that he naturally uses as a director, which is basically next to none. Like no one else is like he'll have two people in the foreground talking, and then a character will walk backwards, and the 3D just really reminds you, oh yeah, this guy knew how to freaking stage, like to always make it feel like depth. So it didn't really get in the way. It didn't feel like a gimmick. It just felt like it was kind of placing you in the room. The 4DX was really subtle, which was
Does it like
surprising.
spritz water at you
Oh
the
yeah,
whole
every
time?
like so somebody's splashing and little bits of water, just light bits of water will come, not all the time, little bits of smoke. But the best part was just slight moving of the chair anytime you're on the water. So it just feels like you're kind of drifting. It's just enough. But there's a couple big moments. But I'll tell you, biggest jump I've had maybe since our smile jump where we had with the smile, the one where they're looking at the sound file and then the jump happened. Okay, yes, this was huge. Like everyone in the theater fucking, and this is a movie that everyone's seen a million times. Well, not the kids next to us, they were coming for the first time, but the Ben Gardner severed head, as it comes, you're waiting for something to come, the whole fucking chair just forces you forward and something blows on your face, and I was just like, ah, it
Whoa.
was really crazy. So it's so cool that this 50-year-old movie still has A, it's and then A, it's just like being reminded it's just one of the best written, best directed, best acted. Like it's hardly even a horror film. Like, and I don't mean that as it's not horror. Of course it's horror, but it's really what 20% of it has any horror in it, and so much of it is drama, and it's such good drama. But and Robert Shaw's Quint is like just a whole different level of what great filmery. But the one thing I picked up that I'm not hearing anyone talk about that I was very excited about is, so this is the 50th anniversary screening, and on the Amity sign, when they're putting up the celebrations, on the Amity sign it says it's the 50th anniversary of Amity. So it's actually the 100th year of the Amity if they're celebrating their 50th. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Anyway, it was a cool way to see it. It might still be playing for a while. I'm not sure. I think it
I'm
did
gonna
really
have to
well.
look. That sounds like something really fun to take my kids to.
I think that would be a cool way to, because it wasn't too much. The 4DX was, I look, the trailers will beat the fuck out of you. Like the trailers beforehand, you're like being thrown around going, oh my God, how's the movie gonna, but this movie, they did it real smart, real subtle, and it just has a couple good big moments in it. And
There was somebody that I had talked to. I'd been so skeptical of 4DX because I can't, it was like Andrew Cash or Brian Collins, somebody that we talk with regularly, had gone to see Twisters on 4DX and basically described it as like a spine cracker the entire time, that it was just uncomfortable and you were just being thrown around and it was just jerky and miserable with wind blowing at you the whole time. And I was kind of like, I'll wait for the technology to improve a little bit. Like I wanted it to be like, when I was a kid, there used to be in Baltimore, if anybody's from Baltimore, I hope you remember this. They used to have this place called the Power Plant, and it was an indoor amusement park that they had in Baltimore in the 1980s. And they had a 4D movie, and it was a roller coaster. And then you would smell the popcorn, and you were like touring an amusement park, and it was like a true 4D movie. And it
Oh, that's
was
cool.
incredible. And then the seats moved with the roller coaster, and I want it to be like that. Like I want that level. And so I kept saying, oh, wait for that. But this one sounds pretty good. Maybe
Wait,
something.
what was the Michael Jackson one that used to be at Disneyland?
EO, Captain
Yeah,
EO.
that
Yeah.
was cool. That like was a cool experience. That was the only first time I remember having this kind of experience. This is only the second time I've gone, but I think for the right thing, it could be fun. You know what I mean? It's it probably doesn't work for you. I will say trivia has made also was going to trivia so many times because I haven't watched Jaws in so long. So many of the key questions have come up multiple times.
Oh yeah.
When it comes up in the movie, it makes me laugh. Like, what kind of ice cream you want? Coffee? And you're like, I really don't know if he's asking for coffee ice cream or asking for coffee.
We proved it. We emailed
Coffee
Carl.
ice cream.
Yeah, we proved it. So for those listening at home, when we do horror trivia, many, many moons ago, I had asked what type of ice cream does he
Little boy, yeah,
request?
that's
Yeah,
the
does
one.
the little boy request when he is like, who wants ice cream? And he responds, coffee. And so I assumed that it was like, was he asking for a cup of coffee? So I think I had phrased it as, what does he ask for instead of ice cream? And I had put the answer as coffee, and somebody else was like, no, he wants coffee ice cream. And I was like, but he's seven. He's not asking for coffee flavored ice cream. And it turns out, yes, he was. We actually ended up because it turned into such a debate at trivia that we had to nix the question of whether the kid was asking for coffee or coffee ice cream. And so then we nixed the question and ended up emailing the screenwriter, and it was that he was asking for coffee ice cream, which was apparently incredibly popular in the Northeast during the time of that movie.
It's
So.
funny. Well, I get the reason I laughed was because the way it's phrased, it really is hard to tell because the way he answers in a weird way and she asks it in a weird way. So it's like two things merging where you're like almost more like he's saying coffee, like give me coffee. But I really do think it is the ice cream, of
And
course.
I will give a mad shout out to Buzz Wallach, who had
Yes.
been on the side of he's asking for coffee ice cream, and Buzz was the one who reached out to the screen maker, the
Yeah.
screenwriter, to ask. So
Yeah.
mad shout out to Buzz Wallach for solving the coffee ice cream mystery for us. But yeah,
Yeah, but
no, we
anyway, so
have
do recommend it if you can do it. Jaws 3D, 4DX, do it.
excellent. Okay. So I watched a lot of new stuff this week. I am going to kick us off with one that we both watched. So I'm going to start with I Know What You Did Last Summer.
All right.
So this one, I have been patiently waiting for this because back in 2014, Mike Flanagan was announced that he was going to do a reboot, and then that
Oh.
fell apart. And then right after the
Did you
pandemic,
see the news today about him?
no, I didn't.
The story I saw just before logging on was that he has just had today creative differences with Blumhouse and is walking away from the Exorcist sequel that he was about to start.
Wow.
Yeah. So, which is probably to me probably a smart thing because he doesn't need an Exorcist sequel. I mean,
Yeah, I mean, I think that The Exorcist has a lot of cooks in the kitchen on that one
yeah.
between studio and Blum. I just feel like there's a lot of voices and that they have a lot in preserving everything. They're not going to do like a Predator thing where they're like, eh, just drop it in this and, like it has to be in canon, I feel
I'm
like. So
thinking from the demon's perspective, okay? Let's give it a
let's
try.
just make it
Let's mix it
about
up.
Pazuzu,
Yeah,
just the
yeah.
whole thing, just Pazuzu's. Let's go back to like Babylonian times. We're all Pazuzu the whole
I
time.
guess they kind of tried that with the one the
Those
traitor
the two
did. They
prequels.
the two failed remakes of each other,
Bethy, when we
reshoots.
did Killer POV, I watched them both back to back and tried to decide which one was better. And I can't
Unremarkable.
remember now. I
No,
can't
I couldn't
remember.
even at the time. I watched them back to back, and they were both very unremarkable. And it was just, I don't know, they both had issues.
But back to I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yes.
So, big fan of the original Lois Lowry book. We were just talking about her last episode as well, because I was talking about Stranger with My Face. That was on our
Oh,
Patreon
yeah.
show. But yeah, so her original book comes out. We had the original film, late 90s. 2014, Flanagan's announced is supposed to do a reboot, falls apart. And then they announce a TV series like right back from the pandemic, like 2021, they announced that they're going to do a TV series. Does not happen either. So I'm excited that we
Oh, no, they
got
did do
this.
it. I saw a TV
Wait.
show.
Oh, you're right. You're right. You're right.
Yeah.
I take that back. I did see that as well. I
But
did
I
watch
don't
that as
know
well.
what happened to it. Like, I don't even know if it
I think
finished
that's why
because
is
I watched like three or four
I only
episodes. I was like,
watched
eh.
three
Yeah.
episodes. I remember the first one being cool and it
I
had
think
a
it was
good panel in
Amazon.
it.
I think it was an
Yeah.
Amazon show.
I
Yeah.
wonder what happened to that. Did that
I mean, it
run for
definitely
a
got.
full season?
It probably did. They probably filmed it first. I just didn't stick with it because at a certain point, it didn't. It wasn't grabbing.
I definitely watched the first three
Yeah.
episodes. Yeah, no, and that's got Madison Eisman in it. I love her.
But you know what? What you forgetting just now is actually symptomatic of it has truly been buried because in all the coverage of this movie, I don't see anyone mention that there was a show. They're just going back to the
No.
original, like they're trying to erase that this property was like literally done a year or two ago. So they're trying to act like it's like, no, you just did it.
Yeah,
Like,
they aired eight episodes. I definitely only watched to the first three.
yeah.
Okay, so that brings us to the brand new movie, which came out mixed reviews this summer, but did pretty well in theaters considering. Like it definitely held its own for a number of weeks. My biggest thing was that they went to great lengths to connect it to the original. They went to great lengths to make sure that this felt like a sequel, a continuation, to the point that at some points it felt kind of wedged in.
By great lengths, she means a studio note that somebody passed a napkin to them and said, inject this
Yes.
into
And
your
so
otherwise okay
and
storyline.
that was it. Is like I was into the story, I was into the characters, I was into the kill, I was into how the whole thing went down and how they covered up the crime and all this. And then all of a sudden it becomes this, we have to connect it to everything that went down in 1997. Very, very fibrously. It has to network, like work its way into every single fiber of this film. That's where I found it to be a little bit much. I loved the kills. There was some fun stuff happening in here.
Well,
Like at one point, it got pretty intense. Like the first kill, I was like, oh shit, okay, we're in now.
it's like, yeah, it's a weird movie because it fails completely by the end. Like by the end, it's just like two things. Madeline Klein, Chase Sui Wonders are clearly the big draw in this movie, and they're both really charming together. But to the point where it feels like at the end of the movie, somebody rewrote it because they heard Madeline Klein was so good and something else, and was like, shit, we can't just have her not make it. Let's rewrite the whole storyline. And I'm watching this movie going like I'm re watching it being written by AI in real time. It was very odd.
Bring her back, man. Bring her
But
back.
I was also kind of glad because she was the most
She's the
watchable thing
most
in the movie.
watchable one in the movie. It's true.
I agree with you. The first kill I think is excellent. The one in the house with the gun thing
With the
and
bathtub, all of it's
yeah, no,
great.
the whole setup. I found this to be a very watchable movie, especially the first half, where I was like, oh, this is perfectly pleasant to watch, if pretty generic and a little silly at times. And then, man, I go like for me, putting the way they put Freddie Prinze and Jennifer Love into this and the way where it takes those two characters
Sarah
is
Michelle
borderline.
Gellar.
Yeah, well, I didn't mind that one, weirdly enough, because it was at least,
A
you know.
nightmare
Yeah.
sequence.
Again, it's not, she's not alive. So, but what, it, how it treated those two characters, I thought was like borderline kind of offended. And I'm not like a purist of the original, but I like that. I like the original. I think it's a very well directed movie. I just thought it was, I thought that's like 0 stars for that part. Like I was like, guys, this is bad the way you're connecting. And I get why they had to do it, but I think it might have flown a bit better if it had been saying a bit more in
Same.
passing, you know?
I'll say for me, it felt the same as the first Ghostbusters reboot, where it felt like they had gone to such great lengths to cameo many of the people from the original that it almost took away from the story, the new story that they were
The
telling.
only difference being in the Ghostbusters, and I agree with you, the Ghostbusters reboot, they like those old characters. In this, it's like these two are treated with like it feels like loathing from a writer.
Loathing,
Like
yeah.
somebody hated these people and thought, oh, we have to put them in, then I'm gonna be awful. Because it just wasn't a
Let's make
very,
them awful.
yeah, I just felt it, you know, cool. There's other ways you could have done it, but I didn't like that. I think it's a movie that really doesn't work ultimately because it really does fall apart in the last like half. But I agree, it was very interesting at start. There's a couple good sequences. It doesn't kind of kill its characters enough. It kind of lets people off the hook a few too many times until it doesn't. But you know, it does feel, and I don't definitely not showing shade at the director, but it feels like one issue I have with some of these movies, when you look at the filmography of the director, it's like you go, so does this person like these kind of movies? Or because she's just made a couple really big comedy type movies, and you're like, but are they just doing a horror film because you offered it to them? Or did they actually like these? Like it's, I never know. And when I watch some of these movies, I'm always like, yeah, you should really get somebody who really wants to make a horror film. Hopefully that was the case, but it felt like she was way more enjoying the comedy elements and the character stuff where they're at baby showers and things like that. So I don't know. Ultimately, it didn't work, but it did have one very exciting thing.
It did. And sadly, it was one of the first characters that was killed. Why'd you have to kill our fan?
A
There is
podcaster in
a
the movie.
podcaster in it who is a horror podcaster, who has a backpack that is covered in various horror patches, and prominently displayed on the backpack is a Colors of the Dark patch. So thank you. Thank you. Why did she have to die? Don't kill our listeners, man.
You have to watch carefully because like I was looking for it because we had been asked. The production designer was did the titles of my movie. She's really talented. And so she had asked, and but you can see it. If you're looking for it, you will definitely
Very
notice it.
prominent.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So that was neat. So extra half star.
Because that was really
Because we
cool.
can be bought.
And she was a fun character, too.
Yeah, but this is like again, this I didn't see enough of the TV show to know, but I do know the show just didn't grab me in time. Like by the time I was out, it was too late. It was like, I don't care. A little
That's
too
so
young.
weird that it's 2021 and I completely forgot that we had watched that and I had stopped after three episodes. It was also around the time there was a couple of teen-driven horror shows that came out right around that time. There was I remember there was one set in a farmhouse as well,
Yeah,
and they're kind
I
of
know what you
blending.
mean.
There was also the one about a group of kids who were gathered for detention. One of them was allergic to peanuts and died from drinking water. And they know that one of us is lying. Like, there was a whole group of them that came out around that same time period, and they're blending in my brain. So now
I will say I wasn't as, and I know you liked the way it was executed, and I had no problem in the directing of it, but I didn't love that the person dies, not the exact same way, but kind of like a car. Like, can't we come up with another way for them to be, like, could they have been driving a boat and knocked over a swimmer or something? Like, why did it have to be basically in the same way that they're responsible? Not exactly, because they were not driving a car.
That also felt like a studio note. What I liked about this is that it was more, they weren't, like, in the original, they were drunk driving and hit somebody along the side of the road. In this one, and this isn't a spoiler because it's like the first 10 minutes of the movie, they're in the middle of the road, like, fucking around, like, you know, literally blocking traffic. And I liked it because it made it more, not, I mean, like, drunk driving is stupid, but this was like, you have caused this. Like, it wasn't like, I did this thing and now I have accidentally done this thing. This was, I am intentionally trying to do this. And this
is
result.
This is a gray area in terms of criminality. Like, whereas drunk driving, if you hit someone, it is a criminal act and you will go to jail for manslaughter. This is kind of like, they're fucking around the road. Yeah, it's their fault. Would they have been, but because of who his dad is and stuff, it gets covered up. Hey, look, it is a watchable movie. It is not a good movie. I don't think it's a good movie, but I think it is watchable in that way where you're like, there's parts that are enjoyable. And a couple of these stars are massive, massive, about to like explode through the roof big. Well, I can't say which. One of the characters, their friend who they were hadn't seen since high school, who kind of comes into it, she's like the one cleaning up after the start, and she becomes their friend again. She is now about to star as JFK Jr.'s, you know, the wife he had, the blonde wife. So she's probably about to become huge because that's the new Ryan Murphy. The next series of his shows is going to be all about JFK Jr. and it's just him and her. So so there's a lot of people in this that are kind of on that precipice thing. But you know, it was all right.
Okay. Now we're going to go. I'm going to take us to the one that has gotten bad reviews, but oh my God, I kind of loved this last two thirds of this film. I'm anxious to see what you think. The Home. So The Home had played theaters this summer and had been gotten very super maligned reviews. And so I hadn't really rushed to see it, but it was playing and I popped it in this past weekend. And I'll say the first third, I was completely bored by, like, because, you know, we're horror fans. We knew exactly where it was going in the first 5 minutes. There was no question what was about to go down and what everybody was doing. But how extreme and bonkers and sleazy it got. I kind of love this movie. So The Home, what'd you think?
So, you know, that's funny because this doesn't happen that often with us. So you were watching it and you write to me going, oh my God, you got to watch The Home. And I was literally at the 30 minute mark when you texted me because our friend Dick had watched it a few days before. And he goes, you have to watch it just so I can talk to you about the ending. Even though he's like, it's not great overall, but it gets really wild at the end, blah, blah, blah. And he's exactly right. I mean, no, I thought I was really glad I watched the last 40. It's really the second half.
The second half, yeah.
But it gets particularly crazy. I don't think we should spoil it because do think that, but we can tell you how crazy it gets. So I think the couple things working against it, Pete Davidson's all wrong for it in some ways. Like, maybe the drug stuff's fine, but he's just not that interesting. But it does really well with casting of the old people. John Glover from 52 Pickup.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
On Fire. Ethan Phillips from Benson and Star Trek. Anyway, so yes. So it's a guy who he lives in a foster family who are super nice. His parents are these really sweet foster parents. And he has a foster older brother. And they're really close. And then one day his foster brother he's been found out that he's died and he's just totally brokenhearted. And it cuts to like 10 years later. Now he's just a total fuck up drug addict, breaking into things, spray painting things. So he's not doing well and he's in and out of juvie. And he gets this one opportunity to go straight that his parents have kind of hooked him up with at a retirement home where he has to just be like caretaker guy. And if he fucks this up, he's probably going to be, you know, charged or something. And then he starts, there's a weird floor that he's not allowed to go to. And then there's weird old people having sex in one room early on in the movie where he's like, what's going on in there? Like, there's lots of
In
weird things.
masks.
Yeah, in masks,
Yeah.
little eyes wide shut, old people. And so the intrigue is there. So it wasn't like boring at the start. It was just a bit generic where it's like, okay. And I just am not like Pete Davidson, unless he's in a crazy funny role. I find him a bit
No,
meh.
I liked him in that film Locked that came, not Locked. I can't remember. I think it was called Locked. The one about him being trapped in the car that came out earlier this year.
No, that's the
That's Skarsgård. Thank you.
But
Okay, never
they
mind.
have the same eye,
They do.
dark eye thing. No,
No,
Pete
that's
Davidson's good
Skarsgård.
in
You're right.
what's the one with the three words?
Bodies, bodies, bodies.
Buddies, buddies. Like
He is.
that's a good use of him, like where he can be this goofy, funny,
I did not mind him in this. I will say,
He's
I
not
think that
bad. It's just I didn't like the cat. Somebody else might have made it a better movie, is all I'm
I
saying.
think somebody else would have made it a different movie. For me, he made it feel even sleazier. It
Yeah,
was
probably.
almost like a Nick Cage where he was functioning on a different wavelength than the rest of the film until the end, and then it caught up to him. It was just a weird wavelength for me, but I was kind of appreciative of him in this. But yes.
Yes, he just digs around until he gets some secrets about like what's going on with these weird, like these really disturbed patients who are on an upper floor that he's not meant to see, versus the kind of nice and all the fun, charming, artsy types of people on the ground floor. And he starts putting pieces together. And then the second half of this, once he discovers a couple of specific things, there's a really good reveal that reminds me a bit of the photo from The Shining. That's all I'll say. And then from there on, it's you're like, all right, this is pretty damn fun. And I got to say, it's one of the more surprising turns in a horror movie this year. So I was actually pitching it to my friend James, who made the other retirement movie this year, and he was explaining how
Rule of
this,
Jenny
yeah,
Penn.
Role of
Yeah.
Jenny Penn didn't get picked up somewhere early on because they were making this movie, and they're like, we already have a retirement. So I thought that's funny, but it's there's something here. I don't, that's why I don't want to ruin it, because I just think it was very fun, and so
Yeah.
people we don't you might find it to still be a 3-star movie, but it will be a fun one, and guaranteed to be a cult movie years from now, because people don't
That's it.
remember, you know.
Yeah, because this, and I will, what I will say without getting spoilery, it gets hyper gory, it gets hyper extreme, and it definitely goes places that I freaking never expected it to go. It gets really sleazy in the best way possible. So yeah, that was kind of my takeaway is it's exactly what you said. The first half, it was just kind of like, oh, okay, I get where it's going. Yeah, the creepy old people. Yep, seen this movie before. And then that twist in halfway through, the movie just exploded for me, and I really enjoyed that second half, especially the last 10 minutes of it where it just goes, guns blazing.
Yeah, being surprised is a nice feeling, because it happens less and less with
I
most movies.
don't think this has 26% on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't think it deserves that low. I really
No,
don't.
but that, critics aren't usually into like bonkers, right?
Bonkers,
Like that's
crazy,
not
sleazy
usually go as
horror.
well. James DeMonaco directed this, and he's obviously done a lot of Purge films, so it's fun to see him doing saying that's not just Purge. I think this is better than most of those, you know what I mean? Because it's more interesting. Well, hopefully people can write to us once you've seen it. Wait till it maybe drops in price, so you won't be as disappointed in renting it. We don't want to have people spending full ticket value and then complaining, but I do think that people will probably have a bit of fun there.
And I agree, this is kind of destined for cult because people will discover it and it's going to be one of these kind of slow, like, oh my God, I can't believe this exists.
People don't get it or like it on first time, and then they have fun with it later, is definitely that's the way to
Yeah.
find the cult movie.
The Home.
Well, I'm glad I mean, I was already starting it, but when you liked it, I was like, okay, this is good timing. So we're doing something simpatica. I saw one that doesn't really work, but was also kind of watchable, so I'll do it real quick. It's a new one called Whisper of the Witch from. So it's basically what's the reason to watch it is I've never really seen many big horror films from Russia. It's a Russian film, new release, but it's literally like it's very generic, but in a way that you haven't really seen from Russia, and it's big. So it feels big and generic, and you're like, huh, I didn't know they could make it. So it's literally just feels like a big Blumhouse film that happens to be Russian, even though it's been dubbed into English. It is this old house, three teenagers jump go in there, and it's about like this whispering their story about this whispering woman who had lived there, and they find this like music box thing that is like a recording of her whispering, and then shit starts going bad, and people start getting, someone gets thrown around and killed, and this cop who used to live there and once went in there as a teenager but hasn't been home since returns to the town to try to solve the crime. police procedural stuff's the way less interesting stuff to me. But all the teen stuff and the actual witch and the way it's shot, it feels like this person could just walk right into making a big, US remake of this with no problem at all, directing wise. Like it's really well done. It's just incredibly generic. So it's like watchable, but it's not necessarily good. But you're like, huh, I've never really seen a movie quite like this because it's where it's from. So I thought that was interesting. And I had some cool stuff.
I will just take this moment to point out that two of my favorite films from the year 2020, when I did my top 10 list at the end of 2020, two of my favorite films were Russian. Sputnik, which was huge,
Yeah, I like Sputnik. That's a
and
really good film.
Super Deep, which was fungus horror. It was about the scientists that were boring down into the ground to like the deepest borehole ever, and what they find is this like fungus that takes over everything,
Oh,
including
yeah.
human
I thought
bodies.
they were the same movie. I saw those
No,
two
no.
mixed them in my brain.
Sputnik is
The
basically,
Klingon, the thing clinging onto you coming back.
it's like, it basically feels like, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of it now. Quatermass, like the first Quatermass movie, where scientists go up and then only one comes back, and you realize he's got something in him. So that's Sputnik, which is huge, and then Super Deep was the fungus horror one underground.
No,
Both
those
of
both
them
make sense to us.
massive.
Yeah, like because they're like also Russian sci-fi as well as horror, and Russia's always done so, obviously Solaris and stuff like that. This is like I just have never seen like this. Literally looks like it's a Blumhouse movie, but it
That
happens to be shot
is,
in Russia, and I've just
yeah.
never seen that. Which is probably smart for them because economically it could pass as not a Russian movie. Like you could just because it was dubbed. I didn't even have the option to watch it and. Its native language, at least where I watch it. So, but I think some people would enjoy it because it is like a very meat and potatoes, ancient spirit throwing people around doing crazy stuff, in a big house kind of spooky film. So, that's
Yes.
Whisper of the Witch.
Where did you see that one?
It must have been on Amazon. I must have paid for that. I can't remember though,
Okay.
but it was online.
So I watched one that is not coming out until October 7th called The Drowned, but we're going to go ahead and talk about it this week because it's fresh on my mind. And this is a UK film that is played at Fright Fest, and it's just kind of making its way over to the States now, coming out from Vertigo and my friends at Raven Banner. And it is about three guys who are criminals, and they all kind of converge on this isolated cabin on the beach after they have pulled off this art heist. Like they've all been involved in this big crime. We're getting flashes of it, and they all arrive separately at this really isolated beach house. And when I say beach, beach makes it sound nice. It is basically a house on a pile of shale with a lot of wind and what looks like really cold water. Like nobody's trying to get in the water. It just looks like a really cold, isolated, windy place. And they arrive there, and they are supposed to be meeting their fourth accomplice, who is a woman, but she is missing. And instead, what they find is blood. They find blood in a couple of the different rooms, and they find blood down by the water. And so they begin to think that one of the other people, one of the other three, killed her to get a bigger piece of the pie. And so, but at the same time, once they arrive, while they're accusing each other, they're kind of like, well, did something happen to her? Could she have gotten here early and something happened to her? They start having really bad headaches. They start losing time. And they're supposed to wait there for a while until the heat dies down, but they're finding like that they're really having problems staying there because they keep losing time. And anytime that they have these kind of mental glitches, they'll end up at the waterfront and not remember what happened in between the time that they were inside the house and then getting to the waterfront. And then out of nowhere, three women show up claiming that their boat has capsized. They're freezing, they're in the water, they're begging for help. And so then it becomes a question of like, do we take them in? What do we say? Why do we say we're here? We still have this stolen art here. What do we do? And it spirals. And I will say, this one is more drama and thriller than I will call it horror, but the horror seeps in and it's slow burn, like definitely. And I'm not usually one for slow burn, but this one kept me captivated because it is an aquatic mythological monster. They begin to question if there is something in the water that maybe took that first woman and is affecting them. So this does kind of spin into a cool mythological tale. It's a small film. This is one that you can see the shoestring budget because it is literally like three guys, one cabin. But at the same time, it really does kind of bring in this awesome contemporary mythological tale to it as well. So this one is headed our way on October 7th, The Drowned.
Okay. All right, my last new one is a movie called Somnium that's in limited release this week. Director Rachel Kane, no relation, though she was this film played at Brooklyn Horror, same as mine. But I think I arrived there the day after because we had some mutual friends work on this, so but I missed it. So this is Yellow Vale's putting this out, and Chloe Levine is really, really good from The Ranger, who we all
Like
really like.
her.
Yeah, I think she brings a lot of heart to whatever she's in. She feels like a just the kind of person, the person who seeps through the performers sometimes. She seems to have that ability. So she plays Gemma, a small town girl from Georgia, who's like leaving a long-term relationship with an actor, Peter Vack, who I think is really good, to want move to LA to become an actor. That's her job, her goal. She has to end this relationship, so it has some stuff that's kind of Malicky back in the hometown, and now she's coming to LA. She gets to LA and is obviously, striking out all over the place, is very naive, thinks she can just go into places asking for jobs, doesn't really work. And then across the street, after she's rejected from saying, she sees a clinic called Somnium, where they are doing this new method where you go in, you go under overnight into a sleep pod, kind of, we've seen many movies with things like this before. And what it does is, whatever your dream is or your hope, it's like subliminally showing you video and talking to you to make you feel like it's possible. So people who have wanted to be pop singers have become successful because they did the Somnium treatment. And so she gets a job working there in the night shift because she it's the the shitty job they're going to give her. And she starts working that at night, and that's one part of her life, and then goes on auditions. And then meanwhile, she meets Jonathan. Is it Sketch? I can never say his name. The guy from Suitable Flesh and other things. He's one of a very recognizable actor.
He was great in Suitable Flash.
Yeah, he was. And he plays this like he's just like this weird, seemingly maybe famous guy who sees her sad one day. He's like, oh, we can help you out. Now it's one of those storylines where, oh, this always ends up with him sexually assaulting her at a party or something, storylines, but it never goes there. And I'm a little confused at why it's in the storyline, to be perfectly honest. But so she's got these two threads going on, and at a certain point she starts noticing her coworker might be up to something shifty using the Somnian stuff for his own plans, and it gets like a little darker there. And there is a kind of a demony thing she sees occasionally. The on the plus side, this is a very inspiring production, and I would recommend anyone wanting to make an indie film to go to Rachel's Instagram, where there's this video where she talks. It's basically 10 years from where she had this idea to putting it on screen, and many years of like and stop and starts of the actual filming, and you can't really tell. Like it's very fluid. I think they shot part of it, and then they had to get money. So it's one of those stories where it's like, at times maybe there's a slightly film school element to the story, because of that, as a result of that. But the execution's still really good, and she's showing what you can pull off, if you just stick with it. So I think it's really worth looking at the story of how this came to be. But that's not a movie, obviously. I think it's still. I found it. I was into it the whole time, like found it interesting. If it suffers from something, it's too many. It's like got maybe three storylines too many or genres jammed into it, where it's like sometimes you'll take to one and it's a little, and it's not their fault because obviously they started this a long time ago, but it has too many similarities to Come True, and Come True is a more interesting movie. Come True is a really great dream clinic, messed up,
It
Hellraiser-y
works.
movie. Yeah, it's a
And it has
really.
a cool twist in it. It's got like a cosmic horror vibe
Yeah,
too.
this has a lot of images and things that, and again, probably not based on it at all. But I do, and a little bit of starry eyes in terms of the acting kind of stuff. But I think, always being forgiving of first features and some of the cool things they bring to it. And I think the fact that she was able to kind of bring this all together and get it done makes it, worthy watch. And
Oh my
it's
gosh,
getting
yeah.
rated really well. So yeah, check out Somnium. And also, I always like sleep clinic movies. Like,
I love sleep clinic
they're
movies.
always interesting and fun.
Any of those ones that are about like sleep problems, or we're gonna, there was a whole spate of movies from about 5 years ago that were all about like sleep clinics where we're supposedly gonna deprive you of sleep just to see what happens.
Yeah.
And you'll be in a nice controlled environment so nobody will get hurt. I watched every single one of those. Like it's just, I'm gonna have to do this as like a whole subsection of movie or
Dreamscape and Nightmare on
Dreamscape
Elm Street.
movies.
I mean, they all come back from that original Nightmare, the story that Nightmare was based on about a dream thing. Yeah. Anyway, so that one's called Somnium.
Okay, so I'm just really quick say I am absolutely loving where the Aliens TV show is going,
Yeah.
and I would watch an entire TV series about Eyeball Spider. Like I
I knew
love
you
the
would like that guy, yeah.
Eyeball. And this is, I'm just going to explain this monster just so that you can understand how cool this thing is and why you should watch the TV show. Is in the new Alien, we spoke about it last episode, that the ship that crashes is a deep space zoological research vessel. So it's basically collecting animals from other planets and then bringing them back to Earth for this one. It's bringing back for Weyland-Yutani. It crashes and is then intercepted by Prodigy, which is another one of the companies who's now collecting all the animals. There's this one little spidery looking thing that has like all these eyeballs on top, and it climbs into animals' faces, rips their face apart, takes the place of their eyeball, and then takes over their brain. But it's highly intelligent, and it's such a cool scene. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So I will
No, I
continue.
mean it's really fun. I mean,
Yeah, I will continue watching the show just for that. I mean, yes, Xenomorphs, that's fun. That's cool. I think they were really smart to bring in other wild stuff like that as well.
yeah, my favorite thing watching it so far is just watching, like, the thing I'm absolutely mesmerized is watching Timothy Oliphant look at things. Like, I don't know what he's thinking because he's a freaking android, and every time he looks at somebody, he gives this weird look that he's computing all the things, like, about the monsters and about the other people. Like, I don't know where his allegiance is, and I find it utterly fascinating. I'm like, man, I just watch this dude's face all the time. He's really good in it. I'm loving not knowing where it's going. And my favorite comment was somebody wrote on our, it's pretty funny. Somebody, after we first talked about it, somebody wrote on our Facebook or somewhere, they're like, it is wild that the exact reason that Elric loves the new Alien show for the exact reasons that he said he didn't like Romulus, which is funny because, like, I like the innocent
So,
young people of the show and I hated the young characters in Prometheus. So who knows? These things are mysterious. I think it's the writing. I think obviously Fetty's a very good director, but the writing of this is what makes it so interesting. He's such a unique
my
person to create
fave
him.
moment of this so far was like the second episode had aired and we were watching it at the same time.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I get a text from you with a picture of just this very generic character from the show that I hadn't even, just very unassuming
Old
character.
bald guy.
Old bald guy number
Yeah.
12.
Yeah.
And then you write, it's Vivian from The Young
It
Ones.
blew my
And then
mind.
I had to like look it up, and it's Vivian from The Young Ones, like
Adrian
the
Edmondson. Adrian fucking
punk.
Edmondson. I mean, I could not. I did a double take. I was watching his face going, he looks familiar. And then the name came up in the credits. I was like, it cannot be Vivian. And then
It's
I looked
Vivian
up
from
and
The
it's
Young
fucking,
Ones.
and he's actually
Vivian
getting,
Bastard from
and
The
he's
Young
actually,
Ones.
his role's getting bigger each
Yeah.
episode. So I get the feeling he's going to play a significant, it's so cool that they cast him. I mean,
Yeah.
that is
He
fucking
is,
cool. Like,
for the first two episodes, he was very much like generic, bald, older guy in
yeah.
suit. And now he's getting cooler. So,
What's
yes.
for dinner? Alien surprise.
Alien.
What's the surprise? Alien. Anyway, thanks, Neil. Anyway, that's
What
very deep for only the few British listeners. No one in
Young
America
Guns played
knows what we're,
here? No,
yeah,
if you
not
were
the
a
same level.
kid in the late 90s, that shit played on Comedy Central in
Okay,
repetition. It's
okay.
the reason I've seen all the Young Ones episodes. They played over and over on
I would say it
Comedy
was the
Central.
most popular show in New Zealand growing up. That, again, Blackadder and Fawlty Towers were like the only things I remember being constantly referenced at comedy-wise. Because we didn't get the American shows as much for comedy. We got like MASH and stuff like that, but and Cheers. But those shows, and especially the Young Ones, were, you know, Vivian was my favorite character. So
Oh, I like Neil.
yeah.
But okay, I'm quickly going to mention two books that I absolutely loved, and then we'll continue
Books,
on.
bigger fucking
I know,
books.
fucking books. Okay,
Fucking read
I
them.
just have to mention Morbidly Curious, A Scientist Explains Why We Can't Look Away. This one's coming out in just a couple of weeks. You need to add it to your read list.
Okay.
Written by Colton Shrivenor, PhD. I'll call you Dr. Shrivenor. I'd been following him on Instagram for a while. And just as like this cool psychologist who talked a lot about kind of fear factor and horror movies and stuff like that. It was just like an academic I thought I connected with. And then he released this book, and I was like, oh man, you just got even cooler. Morbidly Curious, A Scientist Explains Why We Can't Look Away. It's from a psychologist's perspective, but also using a lot of scientific research explaining us, explaining what makes us want to watch true crime shows, what makes us want to watch Saw, what made me be kind of okay with where The Home was until it got like hyper gory and crazy shit started happening. And as soon as the intestines fly, I'm like, well, I'm in. What is it about that? And so it goes through all of the different levels of why we do that and why it's beneficial and why there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. Everything from emotional stability to mental preparation for death to wanting to, kind of taste death without experiencing it, to be wanting the thrill seeking side, to finding the same thing I do, cathartic sides in it, where I can watch something that's like bleak. Like that's when I'll turn on. If I'm in a shitty mood, I put on like my Martyrs, and then somehow at the end of it, I feel better. Like why that is. And it had a lot of like research behind it, where they're like looking at people at haunted houses and scares, and then looking at, you know, therapy through fear. And it was really good. And it just made me feel good. So that is coming out in just a couple weeks. Morbidly Curious: A Scientist Explains Why We Can't Look Away. And then I also just have to give props to this one, because this was one of my recent YA reads that I really liked, called The Bad Ones. This was recommended to me by Bria Grant and Mallory O'Meara from their podcast. This one's by Melissa Albert, and it's about two really good friends in a small town where all of these disappearances have been plaguing people throughout decades. And then one of them disappears. And it's about the other best friend trying to figure out what's going on. And it all goes back to this game that is well known in their town that everybody plays when they're kids, called the Goddess Game, where they say all these rhymes to this particular goddess and ask for her protection. And it is really cool. Like, I'd be surprised if this one is not currently being optioned into a film, because it just did have this very scenic, like as I was reading it, you could picture the film side of it. So for those YA horror fans, The Bad Ones, that was awesome.
I can start reading again because as of today, I finished the Kubrick book that's taken me 2.5 months to read. I've been reading it and watching every one of his films in order. And tonight will be, I'll watch Eyes Wide Shut, so I'll be done with his films. And today I finished the book. And it's not a slog, but it's very biographical about every detail in every movie. It's very in the weeds. It's not the fun, salacious read. It's not like, oh, and then Kubrick did this. It's just like, Kubrick knew this person. He liked Big Macs. And I'm like, and he died at 70. I was actually really sad when I got to the part where he finally died, because I felt like the way I've been reading this,
You knew him.
yeah, like it felt like, oh, he's your kind of crabby uncle. And but anyway, so it's a bit of a relief, because I did read one book on the side, but I'm looking forward to not reading another book, like, you know, those 700 or so page books. I just don't do that
I
anymore.
can't read
No,
them.
I
I
don't do it.
float. Like any of those, especially those like film tomes, I'll float through. Like I got that massive Fulci book, Beyond Terror.
Oh,
You
yeah, I
know,
got
I'll
that one.
like read a chapter here and again. I can't sit down and read it cover to cover like I used to be able to do. Like my mind, unless you know, I'm getting that constant stream of plot to keep me going, I can't do it.
My big trick is to if you're looking for a Goodread hack, because you're trying to get through your 20 books or however many books you're trying to read this year, is I'm just really drawn to Japanese books because they tend to be like 150, 200 pages long, and it's a perfect length for like to get through a book and feel like still excited.
You should
Like, I love
Google
it.
best horror novellas. I have found a ton of really
I love
great
those kind of
reads
books.
that way.
I've been reading a lot of Japanese ones this year. But okay, so to our did you know horror history fact moment, I'm going to lead off only because mine is not a horror fact. It is instead, I'm going to do a mini spotlight because I felt like it's a little under the radar for non-hardcore horror people. And that is a little quick RIP to Scott Spiegel. Scott Spiegel, who is kind of like the lesser known part of this triangle of Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell. They all went to high school together. He passed away about a week ago, but he is like such a key component to so many different, he connects to so many people in the industry in a very interesting way. And he was obviously a very funny, fun loving, you know, humorous, very beloved. I mean, by internally, since he's passed, you only heard. Now, I grew up knowing him from the Evil Dead movies and knowing that he was involved and seeing his name. So it all just like that and Tappert. There was always these same names. But like looking on the internet is really fun. So I found a couple of little facts about him that I'll bring up. What the funny thing is, the internet really knows a lot about his early living situation. It says when he moved to LA, he was living with Sam Raimi, Joel Coen, Ethan Coen, Holly Hunter, Frances McDormand, and Kathy Bates. And then later on, he shared a house with Bob Murawski, who we all know as the editor. And then later, he had a place, and Quentin Tarantino slept on his couch when he was starting his film career and had no money yet. So whether these things are true or just internet things, I mean, I'm sure the Coens and Raimi, I know for a fact, live together. So I thought that was really interesting, just the idea of these people. What's really interesting is, and if and a great if you want to pay tribute to this filmmaker, his movie Intruder that he directed is just a really cool little movie. I really dig it. It's cool supermarket slasher. It's a really neat movie. But it also has a really important thing to play in the careers of people, because this is the did you know part of this. on Intruder, it's the first producing credit of Lawrence Bender doing his very first credit. And then after this movie, Scott Spiegel introduced Lawrence Bender to a young video store clerk named Quentin Tarantino, who then helped over the years. Lawrence Bender ended up directing, producing Pulp Fiction and a bunch of other work of his. So key to Quentin's career is this kickstart from Scott Spiegel. A couple other interesting things, and that I and this one I really liked reading. It was basically how key he is to the whole Evil Dead of it. So Evil Dead 1 came out, did well. Crime Wave comes out and is just a complete disaster. And this is like when they were living with the Coens, and I think the Coens edited it, and the tone just did not land. And this is the part I didn't know. So quickly after that, though, Sam Raimi gets offered Thinner by Stephen King's Thinner and turns it down because he just doesn't see what he could do with it. But then he's also despondent because they don't know what are they going to do next with their career. And they have this idea, well, let's go back to do Evil Dead 2 and let's try to, because we know we can make money in the video market because Evil Dead 1 did well. And it's all, apparently, this is the part that I find absolutely fascinating. It's all Robert Tappert who said, and he's the co-writer on this film. He says, let's not do horror. Let's go all in on the slapstick all the way with the wild fucking crazy, because he's the one who loved Three Stooges the most. And he said, if we do that and we go more towards what Reanimator did, I think this is going to be what the tone of this movie should be. And luckily, Sam was like, all right, fuck it, let's do it. So he really is responsible for why we all freaking
Wow.
think that's one of the greatest movies ever made. Because if it had just been a scary sequel, it might not be the thing that we all talk about because it's this wild, insane quality to that movie that makes it the movie it is. So that's a big part. And he also went on to be the producer who hired Eli Roth to do Hostel. So he's the producer of Hostel. He ended up directing Hostel 3. He did Texas From Dusk Till Dawn 2. So he made his directing career never, even though he kept making movies, obviously never reached the peaks of his friends. But he was always doing stuff and always involved. And always just I feel like always sad when somebody passes a little too early. I think he's 68, and is connected to just so many things in that section of the industry.
Ah, that is, I honestly knew the name. I never knew all the things he had done.
Yeah, no,
So
he's really in
yeah,
there.
that's the whole point of this. Okay. Mine is gonna be a sharp left turn
That's
here
all right.
as we move into ancient maps.
Ooh,
So
okay, I like
for
that.
my did you know fact, because I have been writing this book on aquatic horrors, I wanted to start with the question, why are there all of these crazy sea monsters on ancient maps? Like, did they actually believe that there were all these ferocious monsters lurking somewhere in the ocean? And the answer is not really. And so I went through and I researched this and read a bunch of books on ancient map making and cartography. So I'm giving you the boiled down. So you don't have to read dozens of books on ancient map making and cartography. Is that a lot of these are what were known of ma as mappa mundis, which means map of the world, and people would pay people to make them. And when someone is paying you to make a piece of art, yes, you want it to be kind of geographically correct to the best of the knowledge at the time period, but there was this thing called the horror vacui, vacu. I'm sorry, I'm saying it wrong. It's Latin, which basically meant fear of blank space, which was the idea that if somebody is paying me to make this, I need to make this as ornate as possible. And I don't just want it to be a bunch of water, or to say that we have no clue what is here. You would never say, we have no clue what's over here. And at this time when these were being done, we had no clue where what was going on for most of the world. So instead of saying no clue, we have no idea what's here, they would draw these monsters. And then sometimes. So one, it was maps are a business and being more decorative sells. People, especially elite members of society, wanted to hang these maps up on their walls and they wanted people to study them. And it wasn't even always sea monsters. Sometimes they would have like crazy ornate frames around them and stuff like that. Sometimes it was like demons and stuff like that. They still always had kind of an epic battle quality of like, here's a ship and here's a sea monster the size of New Jersey, which didn't exist at the time. As New Jersey is now. And so it was this whole idea of they're a business. With that, you're being paid for it. You never want to leave bank space. And sometimes, if I don't know what the hell is here on the other side of Asia, I'm just gonna put a giant walrus there because I know those exist. So we're just gonna assume there's a giant walrus there. And sometimes they were actual rumors. Like rumors would come back that, well, I saw a kraken off the coast of Finland last week. Oh, cool. I'll put that in the map. Like they would try to do these to the best that they could. But a lot of times it was like the telephone game. So one person would say, I caught a giant fucking lobster yesterday. And by the time it makes it across three countries to the person who's drawing the map, giant fucking lobster copy, and it's now the size of Sweden. And so that's where a lot of these old-timey monsters came from. My favorite ones that I found was basically they seem to have a misconception of whales at the time. And so everything has water shooting out of its head. And most of these maps, they seem like whales are scarier than sharks. You don't see a lot of sharks on these maps. You see things with water shooting out of their head, like massive. You see giant lobsters. You see these things that kind of look like giant sea scorpions. You see sea serpents, which likely were oar fish or misconceptions about seaweed, stuff like this. And you do see giant pissed off walruses. So people were scared of those. And I think that those are probably real because I looked it up. Real walruses get to about 12 feet in length. So a giant pissed off walrus seems pretty real. But that's why when you look at old timey maps, the oceans are just filled to the brim with lobsters. Lobsters, monsters, walruses, the whole nine. Like it's just filled to the brim with monsters. So,
That's cool.
yeah.
That's interesting. I kind of want an old one like that to put on the wall.
I know. I was looking at some of them, and most of them, they're like in museums now and stuff like that. But the reprints of them are really cool. And I had a lot of fun studying the different types of creatures that you would see in them and kind of what the connective tissue was. And what real creatures they were likely based on. Like somebody saw an oar fish and said, oh, I saw a sea serpent. It was like 200 feet long and had giant frills on its head and probably blew water out because everything did on those maps. So, yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to a
So,
lot of maritime towns this summer and through Scotland and stuff. And yeah, you do see a lot of that same kind of drawing. And even Nessie is obviously coming from that, even though Nessie is true. So
oh, yeah, I forgot that.
Nessie's
Nessie's
real.
totally
I'm
true.
sticking with it. Nessie's real.
Nessie's real. Nessie's real. I feel like we need to make, because we've been talking on our Patreon show about all the movies that are centered around the London Bridge on Lake Havasu, specifically how Jack the Ripper time port, like teleports there in one movie. I feel like Nessie needs to visit. Like we need Nessie Lake Havasu with the
Oh,
London
Nessie
Bridge.
Havasu. That'd be interesting.
See,
Yeah.
that's what I'm saying.
A sighting. I like that.
So, with that, let's bring on one of the classiest journalists I know, Clark Collis.
Welcome back. Joining us is an old friend of the show, probably going back many, many moons, interactions. Coming to us from London, I believe, London time, is the author of the new book, Screaming and Conjuring: The Resurrection and Unstoppable Rise of the Modern Horror Movie. Welcome back, Clark Collis. How you doing?
Thank you so much for having me.
I was talking to you before this. And it, could this could I don't want mean this to come off rude. It's not rude to you, but like me and Becca have been doing these shows in this realm for about 12 years, and we've lived through the period that your book covers. And what I found is often hard for me. We get, a lot of solicitations to cover things on these periods, and I found it hard to often just even open them because I have already experienced my way through these periods. And I opened it up. Well, I read the intro when you first sent it to me, but I was in this Kubrick book and I read the first two chapters this morning with no plan to read that much. I just started going, and every single page, there was a context I had never realized. And I found it kind of exhilarating, to be honest. And I was like, just going, oh, now I'm back into this period, in this case, pre-Scream. And the way you contextualize things, the way you bring new shading to the industry, it's actually really exciting. So on that, massive kudos, because I think I'm hard to win over with this kind of stuff right now.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I want to make clear, because my publisher would want me to make it clear that this is a book for everybody. All right, Rebecca, everybody, this is a book that for 9 years to 90. You don't even need to love horror movies to buy this book. But what certainly when I was writing it, there would be times, I mean, pretty much all the time, where I'd be like, I'm a horror fan. What would I want to read? What tidbit would I want to read? I mean, this is a fairly random example, but I do a section on John Carpenter's Vampires, and that's not a movie I'd ever talked to Carpenter about. And as you know, if you want to talk to Carpenter about music or video games or basketball, then he's your man. But these days, he's probably not. He probably does not have a lot of. He's not an anecdote machine when it comes to recalling the making of Vampires. But so in that case, I interviewed Greg Nicotero, the you know, special effects, makeup effects icon, and he was. I mean, this is really nerdy, but he was talking about designing the vampires' bodies in John Carpenter's Vampires when they burst into flames and their legs are still kicking.
Yeah.
And he said what he wanted to do was recreate the sequence in The Thing when Windows gets burned up and his legs are kicking because he's turned into, you know, he's turned into the alien. They burn him up. His legs are kicking. But he wanted to do that on like a mass scale. With vampires, which is something, to be honest, that 99% of the planet might not be interested in. But
nine-year-olds, Clark, everyone's interested.
I was like thrilled by that little tidbit and thought, oh, that's definitely going in. You know,
well,
hopefully, I've done that again and again through the book.
But being a journalist versus just somebody like writing a book on horror strikes me as a very good sign of somebody willing to go where the interesting stuff took you. And I think that's where maybe I wouldn't normally be into a book like this, but because you're like, oh, I didn't plan that avenue. How much was surprising to you that you learned through this? Just like that truly stuff you're like, oh, I didn't realize this connection when I started on this endeavor.
Well, I would say the hardest thing, and I'm tipping my hat to Rebecca's former employers and I guess all of our sort of spiritual leaders really, but I sat, there's a library in London called the BFI, there's the BFI in London and they have a library and they have every single copy of Fangoria, and I spent the summer of last year going through, you know, Fangoria from 1996 to 2013, and that is pretty complete. You know what I mean? It is very hard to think of questions whose answers might not be in that tome. So that was kind of my guide to try to you know, think up things that might not have been included in Fangoria. And sometimes I succeeded, and sometimes I didn't. I mean, the oddest thing surprised me that I mean, generally speaking, and this is not a book that is really related to my taste in movies. I don't get into like, you know, what's a good horror film, what's a bad horror film, but to decide what horror films I'm going to cover, I did look at the box office charts for each year because you don't want to forget about The Sixth Sense or anything like that. So I would go through that, but then I would think, well, what isn't here? And obviously, like Trick or Treat is an example of a film that wouldn't show up on those charts because it was never released in cinemas. Maybe The Human Centipede, which is a big cultural phenomenon, but not a hit. And then Wes Craven's Cursed, which you know was a huge failure, a commercial failure, well, first failure in every, you know, manner really. But I have to say, talking to the people that worked on Cursed, like Greg Nicotero, like Julie Plec, who was started off as Wes Craven's assistant, and then, you know, eventually co-created The Vampire Diaries, like. They were just like, we could not believe it. I mean, they would, because I mean, Julie Plec was like, they paid us all the time. She was like, I got paid for, you know, working whether there was any work to do or not. And I think it was Patrick Lussier, the editor, who was brought in to help out. Obviously, he's a director in his own right. But he was saying that he was sure that film cost $100 million. And if you look at it, it does not look like a $100 million movie. Yeah.
Were there any, and I hope that I'm coming through, I'll warn the listeners, my internet decided to get all funky a couple minutes ago, so bear with me. But I'm curious if there were any rediscoveries that you were like, you know what, after 20 years away from this movie, I really appreciate it. Like, did you suddenly watch Cursed again and go, you know what, there's a gem in here, or any other movies? Not well, Cursed, because, but maybe some of the other ones.
Very much, I mean, the thing about Cursed is I did watch it. And I thought, well, if you told me this had cost $10 million and, you know, Fine. I was generally surprised by how much a lot of the films of the 2000s stood up. To my shame, I tend to watch films on the grubby screened little computer that I'm using here. So I don't have a big system or anything, but I watched The Descent with my girlfriend. And that's something that I remembered being an absolute scare machine when I first saw it. And I thought, I bet it's not as scary. And it was. We literally jumped off the couch at one point when the you know what's turned up. And yeah, I was delighted by how much, I mean, like Hostel, you're like, wow, like this is in the best way, this is unpleasant, and like, I mean, I always had a soft spot for various reasons for You're Next, and just because that sort of, I remember seeing You're Next and thinking, who are all these people? Because I was unfamiliar with the cast, most of which are film directors, so that would at least somewhat explain that. But that's a treat as well. I mean, I was surprised by how much of these movies stood up. I mean, I did not, hand on heart, the book. I mean, with a lot of these franchises like Underworld or Resident Evil, what I essentially do is cover the first movie and then sort of somewhat yada yada the sequels. Although not always, like Saw 2, which has an even more has an even crazier story than Saw, really. I go into some depth on that, but I can't claim. I mean, I have seen. I'm sure I saw all the Resident Evil movies on a big screen when they came out, but I did not revisit every one of them.
Oh,
Wow.
what shameful behavior, Clark.
I
Not
know.
my fault. I do want to set the scene because reading the intro was really interesting, but set the scene of where Har was when from the moment this book is set. Just because I think that'll help contextualize what the book is about. But like, where was Har? Because I remember seeing Scream in my first month of university. So I just got into university and it came out, and it was almost like an experience that brought us all together, all these new friends and new people, and we're all so blown away. But prior to that, I'd become pretty unenamored by things of the last few years leading up to this. So maybe set the picture of what kind of launches the book.
Well, first off, I don't want people writing letters to me or emails, saying that the early 90s were a golden age of horror. Because if you believe that, it's fine. That's great. Fine. Good for you. But for the most part, I mean, the 80s had been dominated by, the slasher craze, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th. But by the early 90s, they had started to get pretty tired. And the grosses were getting smaller and smaller, and the budgets were getting smaller and smaller. And as you folks know, they were just sort of basically dragging someone out of a class at film school to make a film. So that's not in a good state. Plus, you do have big budget horror. You do have like Interview with the Vampire and Bram Stoker's Dracula and Frankenstein with Robert De Niro. But I think if you're a horror fan, you probably look at that as something slightly different. If you're a diehard horror fan, it's as much a sort of period drama as anything else. Plus, for one reason or another, basically, for one reason or another, they were not franchisable, or certainly were not franchised. I know they had thoughts about turning Interview with a Vampire into a franchise, but it didn't work. Now, you do have obviously Candyman and some other movies that are great. It's not like it's a total desert, but compared, I think, to the 70s and particularly the 80s in terms of the sheer number of horror movies that were coming out of, at least some quality, then it's really in the toilet by the mid 90s. And I think the statistic is in the book, but it's like the most successful or the only film to be in like the top 50 or even the top 100, I think, in like 1995, that could be considered a horror movie was Species, basically.
Oh, wow.
Nothing wrong with Species, but
Yeah,
that
that's a
was
thing.
like the pretty much the beginning and the end of successful box office horror in the mid 90s. And then even before Scream, you had From Dusk Till Dawn, and you had The Craft. But I think they both sort of topped out at $30 million. And this book isn't just about box office. I hope, you know, people appreciate, you know, it's about craft and quality as well. But that is one way that you can sort of, I mean, this isn't a book about my opinions, but that sort of box office is one way that you can sort of gauge where the zeitgeist was at the time. And then Scream happened, and it just sort of changed everything. You had simultaneously, you had this avalanche of teen slasher movies, plus you had this golden age of Hollywood anyway. So 1999 sees, I mean, actually, I don't think there are really any slasher movies released in 1999, but what you do have is Blair Witch Project, The Sixth Sense. You've got End of, well, The Mummy, Stir of Echoes, Stigmata, Deep Blue Sea. I know obviously Rebecca's not a
Saw every
fan of
one of
necrotic
those
horror.
in a
Yeah,
theater.
so
Theater. Oh my
you've
gosh,
got,
yeah.
you know, one up Ravenous, Idle Hands, you know, one after another. And then, I mean, one of the things that I found very interesting was you have essentially 3 years of, aside from those films, you have 3 years of teen slasher, 4 years of teen slasher movies, and then you have what would become known as torture porn coming in, which can be seen very much as a reaction to that. And then you have sort of 4 years of that. And then you have a sort of, you're entering a different period with Paranormal Activity and sort of supernatural horror.
Yeah, you have to go, like, I think the fatigue, because there's so much at the end of the 80s that there has to be some sort of fatigue sets in. So the early 90s, you see that fatigue. And then for something to be reinvented, you have to miss it for a little bit. And I think that's what makes sense with Scream coming when it does. There's like 6 years or 7 years almost of almost missing a subgenre, but understanding the references to it because they've still been doing well on video and whatnot. So I think it's so interesting because living through that, we're not thinking that way. Like living through it, we're
No.
consuming what comes out. Candyman was huge to me, but I don't remember anything else from that year. Like, so, you know, that totally makes sense.
Sorry. Well, I was just going to say, you're absolutely right. But I went and saw all these films in the 2000s, and one of the great pleasures, and I wasn't sitting there thinking, oh yeah, well, you know, Hostel is very much a reaction to this and that, and it's, you know, I'm not thinking about it in the context of a broader situation. But it was fun to go back and kind of unpick some of that stuff. So before I wrote this book, I never understood what Lionsgate was. I mean, I literally did. All I knew was that I would be watching movies in the early 2000s, and suddenly there's this crazy, like, machine, you know, Gears machine logo, and it would say Lionsgate. And of course, I would. I'm like, all right, fine, it's Lionsgate. I don't know who they are, but I don't care because I'm now going to watch, you know, watch the actual movie. And then to go back and, I mean, long story short, it was like founded by some Canadian businessman that wanted to have like a Canada-based sort of major studio, and they struggled for, you know, 3 or 4 years, not really having a hit. And then Peter Block, who I mean, one of the inspirations for this was hearing you guys interviewing Peter Block years and years and years ago. But you know, Peter Block and Jason Constantine and other people were sort of keeping their eye out for like cheap horror because they knew you could turn a profit on it, especially with DVDs at its height. And then before they knew it, the people in charge of the company weren't necessarily fans of horror, and like the horror guys. And I was digging out these Fortune articles that are like, you know, Lionsgate is this financial juggernaut, but it's not because of the films they thought they were going to make. It's because of Tyler Perry movies, which are very successful, plus Saw and Hostel, which were movies that, you know, they weren't, especially with Saw. I mean, they had no intention of, the people at the top of the company had no intention of putting that in cinemas anyway, but these were not, you know, these were not, it was very much a battle between people like Peter Block and Jason Constantine on the one hand, who, you know, were promoting horror, and other people that wanted to make movies that they could talk about when they're at dinner parties, essentially, which did not include anything being made by Rob Zombie or Eli Roth or James Wan.
It's the audience leading. The audiences are basically defining these companies because they're suddenly these things are hits. I mean, even torture porn, that's a really good point about missing things that we're talking about, which is like, I definitely didn't miss those movies after the first year or so or two of them. But
Yeah.
now, if you told me there was going to be somebody bringing back, not just bringing back Saw, but bring back that feeling maybe of a French extreme film or of a film like Saw, I would be very excited because we now have moved very far away from that as our normal release to more like A24 or Neon type horror for the most part. So yeah, these patterns keep kind of reinventing themselves.
Well, I'd agree, except that we had Saw X last year or the
No,
year
we,
before.
that's right. We still have Saw, but
So,
I mean more like ones that aren't Saw. Like I miss the ones that aren't the franchises that already existed. Sorry. Sorry, Becca. We can't see Becca, so we need to throw to Becca. I'm throwing to Becca.
No, my internet is all to fuck today, so I'm doing my best. But I want to know, looking at that, what was it that made you stop at Conjuring? What was it about Conjuring specifically that kind of made you say, okay, there's something here that I can cap with?
Well, it took me 2 seconds to decide to start with Scream for all the, because for all the reasons contained in the conversation that we just had. And it hurt my heart trying to work out quite when to stop it. I didn't want to go up to the present day for two reasons. One of which was I think you can't see the wood for the trees in terms of if someone was what, someone was to say, what's the state of horror in 2025, I couldn't tell them, but I can tell them what the state of horror was in 2005. I think you do need that perspective. But also, I mean, the book, you could, if you drop a book on somebody, it's gonna kill them. I mean, this book couldn't be any bigger. It literally couldn't be any bigger. And I did want to have space to, spend time with a lot of filmmakers properly. And their movies, and I didn't want it to be too rushed. That was the other reason I didn't want to go up to the present day. I had a couple of thoughts with regards to where to end up. I did think maybe Paranormal Activity, which seemed, which was like there was a point in the late 2000s when horror did seem to be a bit on its uppers again. There were various movies that didn't do as well as they thought they were going to do, and Paranormal Activity was very much, back to that, idea of a movie made for, 10 grand that then becomes a box office phenomenon. But the problem with that is because it was produced by Jason Blum, then I felt really that I wanted to sort of follow him for a bit. Plus, I wanted to wind up, I mean, James Wan is a big figure in this book, and I didn't want to leave him sort of, having m made a couple of box office misfires after Saw. So The Conjuring seemed good. I did think also about ending it with Get Out, which seems like a very special film. It was a box office hit and obviously nominated for Academy Awards. But then again, that sort of seems like the start of something else. That seems like the start of what you could call, although it wasn't a, what you could call A24 horror, even though that wasn't an A24 movie. So I thought, I mean, The Conjuring is like the most successful horror franchise of all time, and the first one did come out during the summer and sort of beat all comers. It murdered R.I.P.D. if you remember that Jeff Bridges movie, which they thought was
Oh
going to win the
yeah,
weekend.
that was a rough one.
It had a lot of its competition was Red 2, and Red had been quite successful. That Bruce Willis action movie, R.I.P.D. And there was an animated snail movie called Turbo, and Conjuring just murdered them all, and then went on to become the most successful franchise of all time. So that did seem like a good endpoint. Plus, I could then call it Screaming Conjuring, which seemed like,
Yeah,
a
it's a
title
great.
I would remember. I did think about calling it Screaming Soaring and Conjuring, but I think I made the right choice. I just feel a bit guilty about where I ended it, to be honest with you. I'm happy with how it starts, but it could have ended, but it's just testament really to the fact that horror, just has gone on being more and more popular. I mean, I'm glad that I had such a problem rather than being in a position to say, oh yeah, well, 2013 was where it all, ended.
Well, we're recording this conversation in a moment where Weapons has been number one for 3 weeks in a row. Again, a pretty outside the box horror movie, and a pretty high end. So it is exciting that it keeps coming. But like you talk about, even the old spooky house movies were had way lost their favor by the time Conjuring pops up. So again, there's another chance to reinvent these things that then go on to become like, and we're, this is the year where we're going to get the last Conjuring movie. So I think or apparently the last Conjuring movie. So I think your timing is pretty apt there. And I do think from Paranormal onwards, that could be a different book about the rise of independence coming back and being able to, the fact that we can make a horror film on our own now. You always could a little bit, but now more than ever. I think maybe that's book two. How burned out were you by the end of this one?
Not by the writing. That was fine.
Yeah,
I enjoyed that a lot. Although there was one week that I realized I had to cut like 80,000 words from the text, which is, for those who don't know, is the length of a fair-sized book. Because it was, the published book is 150,000. And it had gone out, because that was the problem. I'd interview like Greg Nicotero and I'd think, oh, I got anecdotes for like 12 movies here. I just would stick them in without thinking too much about it. And eventually it just absolutely blew up. But writing it was fun. Talking to people was fun. Writing it was fun. Proofing it was a nightmare. I mean, and then proofing it was an absolute nightmare because it's just so long, and also there's just a lot of information in it. Yeah. And I realized at one point, what I think my indexer said, that he'd seen a couple of incorrectly italicized commas. So I did one proof that was just looking at commas in the book, because I had these lists of films and the names of films are in italics, but the commas have to be not in italics. This is really boring, but I spent 2 days reading this book again, just looking for the commas. So I haven't felt like, it's funny. I've got like three boxes of books and they're just sitting in a corner. Sort of, I haven't really broken them out to look at them too much.
Yeah. Luckily writing books gets you rich. So I'm happy for that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It was publication day yesterday, which I spent waiting for a plumber to come around and unclog a sink, just like Stephen King does, I imagine.
Well, I think it's important for people, because you were talking about indexes and the length of the book. The thing that I was finding was that it's so breezy as I started reading that I was just like, I was scorching through it. Like, and so to me, I don't think it reads like, you know, some long text. It's like all these different anecdotes being weaved together to create a picture of what was going on. And kind of, honestly, for me, it was kind of inspiring on the, you can just, you know, whatever trend's coming and you've got an idea, you can always turn it around to do something, to take a big swing in this industry, you know, because horror does always come around. We definitely want to leave it with people to want to explore this themselves. I just realized mine's not an official copy. I read the second page. It says, this is not a book. What you're reading is some sort of unfinished book. But this is out now everywhere in hardback, or what's the story?
Yeah. 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 You can get it on the 1984 publishing website or anywhere on the internet. Well, not anywhere on the internet, obviously, but it shouldn't be too hard to find.
Yeah, no, really, really enjoying this. And I'll report back when I finish. And sorry, I apologize for Becca, because I know she's struggling with her internet in and out. But always really good to catch up with you. When you're back in town, we got to all hang out.
Yeah, I would love that. And thank you. I should say before we leave, thank you so much. You've always been, you and Rebecca have always been so good at promoting things I do. My publisher, Matthew from 984 Publishing, was at a nightmare weekend convention in Cleveland last weekend, Cleveland Rocks. And this couple turned up and one of them said to the other, and they looked at my book, and one of them said to the other, that's what Elric and Rebecca were talking about on Colors of the Dark the other week. And then they bought it. Nice. So,
oh. You know.
I owe you probably a pint between you, I think.
A dollar residual, probably. Always great to hear. And thanks for the mention of the movie in your intro. I liked being part of all the modern movies. I was like, oh, I'll take it.
Rebecca, did you look yourself up in the index? Oh, it hasn't got an index, has it? Okay, all right.
We'll have our scour after this.
There may be a mention of a certain Rebecca McKendry movie at the end.
Nice. All right. Well, I'll speak for her because she's internet paused. thanks so much for joining us. all the way from England. And yeah, get this book. I'm gonna I mean it when I say it. I am going to be plowing through the rest of it. And often I struggle with these things. So let's you know, there's a lot of tidbits even on page one. Let me just put it this way for the real horror heads. Page one is about Don Coscarelli. This is not what I expect when I open a movie on this period of filmmaking, and it made me so happy because he's one of my favorites. So thanks for that, Clark.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, now to recommend something. Can be anything from the world of horror. This is my favorite thing we've added to the show
Yeah, same, because it's
because,
just so random and I don't have to,
yes.
doesn't have to be recent, doesn't have to be a rationale for including it. It's just, hey, this thing.
And I think it's good because, like, we've been doing the show for so long. I feel like sometimes you run out of steam repeating yourself on certain things. But then there's things like, oh, I haven't thought about that book or that movie for so long that you go back to it. Mine comes from that. And it actually has a really cool twist that I learned today. So mine is this compendium book that I stumbled across a couple months back that I owned when I was young because I was going through a big Clive Barker phase. It is Clive Barker's A to Z of Horror. And
Ooh.
this was a book that when I was like getting into Clive Barker, I really dug it because it is basically he goes through and it's and compiled by someone called Stephen Jones. So he doesn't do all the writing,
Oh,
but
Stephen Jones does a
a
lot
lot,
of
yeah, a lot
those
of horror
fans.
stuff.
Yeah.
So what's cool about the chapters, this isn't trying to be a huge tome. This is like nice and thin and very concise. But what it'll do is like letter A for American Psycho, instead of trying to fit in everything in A for American Psycho just means Ed Gein. And it just traces Ed Gein for a few pages, and then all the various spin-offs from Ed Gein and how that is that's the birth of where the horror was found from within the man. Prior to that, almost all horror was like some creature coming from a different country, Transylvania, whatever the curse was. But this is one of the, so that's A, or C is for chaos, or E is for escape, and it'll be all about you know, not won't be about literally about one movie called Escape, but it'll be about something a little broader. And I think so it makes for a much more personal kind of odyssey. But I'm reading this book today and I'm flicking through my book, and that's all I knew that it was. And I was going to talk about it anyway. And I was very excited because I hadn't flicked through it since I was probably 17 or something. And then my mind was blown when I looked closer on the book and it says, based on the BBC TV show. And I'm like, what? Lo and behold, just like Eli Roth's History of Horror, there was a series called on BBC when we didn't have BBC when we were young called Clive Barker's A to Z of Horror. And there were six episodes and they're all on YouTube. And
Whoa.
I watched the first one today and it's fucking great. It was like a 45-minute documentary about Ed Gein, episode one. And it just goes all in.
Wow.
Episode two, that one of the episodes is all about Dennis Wheatley, the writer of Devil Rides Out, and this British author. So the whole episode is about how important he is to British horror. And I'm like, oh, I'm watching that one next. And that is a chapter in this book. But so it was one season. Clive is the host, so he comes in at the start and does his little talking. It's very young. He's probably like in his early 30s or whatever. And man, talk about a discovery! I had no idea that show existed, and I had this book, and I had never noticed that it had said based on the show that I obviously didn't get in New Zealand and YouTube didn't exist. And so I got really lucky. So you people all got lucky that I figured that out today when I was going to talk about this anyway. So the book is awesome, and I'm sure you can find cheap secondhand copies, you know, on the internet. And it really is a beautiful, he does a lot of drawings, has a lot of pictures, really nice horror tome, like a really cool one. But the series on BBC, it's on one guy's channel. He seems to have all six of the episodes. And I'm going to start watching all of them.
That is a good rec. I've never even read that book. I knew very vaguely that he had done a TV show for BBC, but I never knew what it was called and
Yeah,
I'd
I didn't
never
know it.
seen it. So that is fantastic.
Something
I want to
you would
see the,
like. Oh, sorry.
oh, I was going to say, I want to see the one on Dennis Wheatley.
Yeah, that I'm interested because that's all because most of the other things we know. What you would like about the book, I can't say for the show, is he treats, and this Clive makes sense because he's a novelist. He treats films, literature, comic books. There's a whole chapter on horror comics, theater. There's a whole thing on the Grand Guignol, true crime. He treats them all completely equally when he talks about horror. He's not treating it like horror movies.
Nice.
He thinks it's all relevant and all speaks to each other. So I know that lines up with your view of.
It definitely does. Which brings me to my horror rec, since you're talking about how I treat all horror equally.
Yeah.
Today, I'm going to talk about a playwright. And this playwright was recommended to me by one of our listeners who like sent me a message on Blue Sky and was like, "Oh my gosh, you have to check out Alistair McDowell." And so I started with the play that this person had recommended to me called Panoma. And he recommended it to me and like wrote, you know, "I know you're into theater. I know you're into weird abstract theater. This one is super abstract. It feels a lot like Waiting for Godot, but it's got a lot of Cthulhu in it too." I was like, okay, well, my interest is piqued. And so I had read his play, Panoma, first. And how I will explain Alistair McDowell is it feels like if David Lynch was writing plays. Is the best way I can describe it, where every single one feels like a puzzle. You're watching all of these disjointed scenes where you're trying to figure it out, you're trying to make sense of it, but there's always something off. Even if you're watching the most mundane conversation, there's always something that feels slightly off, either about the phrasing or what they're saying or how one particular character is responding. And there, you're getting clues the entire time of what is going on, but whatever you think is going on, that's not it. And it is much, much worse. And so I very much put these in the same vein as I would David Lynch, because I've been reading these and would love to see them. They don't get made here in the States. I had to buy both. I bought two of his plays so far, Panoma, and the one I'll talk about second is X. And both of them I had to buy from UK bookshops where they take like 6 weeks to get to me. Worth it though. So the first one, Pomona, is set in Manchester, and it's about this guy, Ollie, who is searching for his sister in the middle of like deep inner city Manchester. And he finds that all roads, that it's very kind of abstract, all roads lead to this central abandoned concrete island in the middle of the city called Pomona. And he is connected to this guy who everybody says, well, if she went to Pomona, he knows where she is. And he starts talking to him, and it just gets really abstract. And I will just drop words of where this goes. Cthulhu comes into play. It gets super absurdist. There's a lot of organ harvesting. It gets super violent and really fucked up. And there's a lot to do with Rubik's cubes as well. And so it just gets super horror, but really David Lynchian, where it seethes in and you never really know what's going on until you understand everything. And by then it's too late and everything is fucked. And so the one that I read over the weekend that I was just floored by, I like this one. This is by far my fave out of the two so far. And again, I had to order a copy from the UK and it took like 4 weeks to get here. This one's called X, and it follows five astronauts who are stuck in a space research station on Pluto. And they have lost, which sounds like a crazy out there staging, but it's literally just they're inside a space station. They stay there the whole time. And they've lost contact with Earth. So they're really trying to contact Earth to see what's going on. You get the idea that things aren't so great on Earth, that there's been some like eco badness, and that a lot of people have had to start living underground. And so they're on Pluto researching the planet, and they've lost contact with Earth. And so they're desperately trying to get contact with Earth, but at the same time, the research facility is starting to malfunction and things are going wrong with the machines and they're acting weird. And with that, people start forgetting things. You start getting these mental slips. And then they start finding symbols everywhere. They start finding these X's drawn in blood, sometimes on the outside windows of their facility. And then they're starting to lose time. Something's happening with the time. Time starts kind of breaking down. But then they start seeing things moving around the facility. And you are all inside the facility the entire time with them, but you're seeing these things kind of moving outside the windows. Again, the audience, you think you know what's going on. Where like you're immediately like, oh my God, it's aliens and whatever, or space madness. Like immediately you start making, you know, conjectures about what it is, but whatever you it is, you're wrong. And it's been feeding you concepts the entire time. So this one was just like a slow slip into, I'll just say, very Lynchian territory for both of these.
Have these been put on in America?
Not as far as I could tell anywhere in, you know, the Los Angeles area, because immediately I was like, I want to see one of these. Because X, I can describe this. Actually, somebody had put it up on Goodreads as its Arrival meets Annihilation meets Waiting for Godot. And that's like everything I love in the world. And they're both really cosmic. They both have these really kind of strong, not cosmic as like the second one's in space. The first one is not. The first one's in the middle of the city, but it's cosmic kind of philosophies of madness and knowledge. No, these are not getting staged a lot in the US. And again, these books aren't even in print here in the US. So I wanted to put this on people's radar because I'm now, it's rare that I find plays where I'm like, oh, that's a horror play. Like I look at The Pillow Man, that one's like a straight up horror play. It's rare that I find that. Alistair MacDowell is writing horror plays. Like these are true frightening plays. So I
That's
want
cool.
these to be staged now. So I'm
Yeah,
going
it'd
to
be
have
fun
to.
to see a play that's horror, like being in the dark and watching stuff live if you could feel tension that way. I remember Ghost Stories, that movie from a couple of years back, was a play first in London, right? And
Yeah.
I would have
And
loved to have seen that.
there was one that I saw a couple of years ago that played in downtown LA that Constance Wu was in, which is why I went to see it, that I think was called like 302 or 203 or something. It was a time where every night at this very particular time, a woman who had just given birth was in a new apartment, heard screams, and it was all about her friends coming over, and she was begging her friends to stick around for this particular times to see if the screams happened again. And so that one was like a straight up horror play. But these ones, I can't even call these straight horror plays because it's not ghosts. It's Lynchian, where it's just this abstract world, the nightmare seeps in, or it's been there all along and you don't realize it's there.
Well, I can tell you it's a nice tie back. The last time I read horror plays, I just looked up, it was called Incarnations, and it was three plays by Clive Barker, Colossus, The History of the
Oh.
Devil, and Frankenstein Love. I read those when I was like 21 or something, and I thought they're especially History of the Devil, I thought was great. I think that's what Doug Bradley acted in first for Clive before they made Hellraiser, that he was staging these plays. But so yeah, so horror plays, bringing them back.
Yeah, so I don't even know how to get these staged here in the States. Maybe I'll try to do it myself, but man, these are if you're a fan of David Lynch, these are bangers. So, Alistair MacDowell, Pomona and X. And with that, okay, and before we go, I'm going to hit you with two more of these Scandinavian trivia questions because I said I was going to taper them throughout and then I never did. You know what? We might do three. Okay. Dick Moss helms this bonkers 1988 film about a serial killer stalking the canals of Netherlands' capital city.
Amsterdamed.
Boom! Ari Aster's Midsommar is set in which Scandinavian country?
Ooh. I'm gonna guess Sweden.
It is correct.
I knew
Okay.
Sweden was with answer to something. I got
Number,
wrong.
this is was the fifth one. This Norwegian 2010 found footage film was the first film of director Andre Øvredal's.
Trolls?
Troll Hunter.
Oh, yeah, I knew it.
Close.
I knew what it was. I could see it, but yes, I never actually watched it, so I don't deserve to get it.
Okay, and this one is basically just a give. This silent Swedish witch film from 1922 is part documentary and part reenactment.
Jackson.
Excellent.
Jackson.
So you would have aced
All right,
the
good.
Scandinavian horror
You know
round.
I like the
So
foreign stuff.
always, always. So with that, thank you all for listening. Please check out our Patreon show, Deep Cuts, where we've been putting a ton of weird stuff lately. It's gotten really weird over there. But Elric's been digging up all these like crazy bonkers Japanese films, and I've been
Yeah.
finding weird stuff on Tubi. So it's been good times over there.
It has been.
So yeah, thank you all so much for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another show. See,
That
it's
was
a
a
much better
much
ending.
more fun ending. All
Much
right.
more fun.
Good stuff.
Check us out over on our Patreon show, Deep Cuts. We're always putting up weird stuff over there. So especially things like
Lately.
some of the stuff that we mentioned tonight. No, we've been getting some wild stuff
Weird
over
stuff
there
lately, yeah.
recently. Yeah.
Yes, go there, and we will see you in a couple weeks here for some more exciting new films.